The aging woman in the hospital bed looked pretty good, except for that mashed, bumpy hair that you get when you have to give up your normal hairstyling routine for a few days. Her appearance was encouraging, though, I thought. Maybe there's nothing too wrong with her. I was a new seminary student just beginning a pastoral care class, and I was on my first visit of the practical part of the class. That involved weekly visits to an assigned hospital or nursing home. I had showed up at the hospital chaplain's office as I had been instructed to do. The chaplain wasn't there, but there was a list there with my name on it. It also had patients' names and room numbers. No condition, no disease or surgery, no day they were going home, not even how to find the rooms, and that was no easy task in that hospital. The week before our practical work began, one of the students said in class, "We're about to start the visiting, and you haven't told us what to do yet." "That's right," said the professor, "I haven't." We waited. He didn't say any more. Eventually, we were told, "Remember, when you go into a hospital room, you don't go in alone. God is with you. Trust God." Well, yikes, I thought. I am not sure that I'm ready to do this. But that was all the instruction I had. My very first visit was with this somewhat frail-looking lady, who was nevertheless cheerful and very willing to engage in conversation. I spent more time with her than I expected and said far less than I expected. I sat with her while she told me how she felt about what she called my friend God. When I began the process of leaving, she asked me if I would pray with her. "Don't freak," I told myself. "You knew perfectly well this might happen." I extended my hand to her, and I took in some oxygen. And I remember nothing at all about my first effort to pray with somebody in a hospital bed, except the comfort that I took from that firm, strong grip, her hand holding my hand. The confidence I felt that whatever was wrong with her, she was going to be all right. After our prayer, she told me that she was glad I'd come to see her. "When you came in, you looked so nervous," she laughed. I thought, "What in the world? Who is that poor soul coming in here to see me?" "I was nervous," I said. "You're the first person I visited." "Well," she decided, "I think God might have sent you to me today." "I don't know," I said. "I think God might have sent you to me." The prayer I spoke that day was clearly not memorable or poetic or touching or inspiring or profound, but that's okay because the prayer I spoke was not the real prayer. The real prayer was the experience that we shared. The real prayer was together, each in our own way. She had one way and I had another, but together we trusted God. And trusting God is a prayer. Anne Lamott writes that she herself has only two prayers. "Thank you, thank you, thank you. And help me, help me, help me." I have adopted those as my own when I pray privately using spoken words. And I've added another that was taught to me by my Quaker friend. "Bless me with what I need." The power of this prayer, I believe, is that it doesn't name outcomes. It does not plead, "Give me something, fix me something, make things okay," not "cure somebody's illness or help me find a job or keep somebody from dying." Instead, this prayer opens the way for me to embrace whatever is getting ready to come, confident that my needs will be met, confident that I am blessed. Most of the time, though, my prayers don't involve spoken words at all. In her book, The Path of Prayer, Sophie Burnham says that prayer is a yearning of the heart to communicate with the source of love. And it's a means by which we can be provided with strength and energy. That love, she says, and I agree, is always available to us, even when we feel far removed from it. Sometimes an effective way to enter it, to feel less distanced, is to do something that we truly love to do. And I'm talking about ride a bike, or go into the garden and work, or listen to music, or make music, or knit, or work with clay, or whatever you love to do with your hands. And another way to be close to that source is to ask. To ask for what we need. Bless me with what I need. Does that sound radical to you? I know for some people it does. Asking for what we need is a pretty wild idea for some of us. We aren't used to that. We may not be very good at that, but we can. Another way to feel more engaged with that source of love is to offer gratitude. There's a Native American belief that there is a spirit world like this world, except everything that we could ever want or need is there. And the way to draw that down from the spirit world to our world is to be grateful for it. So if your family is hungry and you're getting ready to go out on a hunt, you don't pray, I hope I find a good kill on this hunt. You pray, thank you for the plentiful food that will be supplied to me on this hunt. Your gratitude, along with the conviction that you will be blessed with what you need, is what brings that to you. Another wild idea. I didn't believe in prayer for a long time, and that was because I was limiting my definition of prayer to what I learned when I was a child. And that was not very much. I learned how to say, now I lay me down to sleep at night, and I learned how to say, God is great, God is good, at dinner. We did not pray at breakfast, and I never could figure that out. And I never found out why. That's what I mean when I say I didn't learn anything about prayer. How come you don't pray at breakfast? I just learned the words to say, and that clearly was not enough. That's what I reverted to, though, in a time of deep desperation. A couple who became my friends in seminary announced that they were going to have a baby, a second child. We had only a short time to celebrate, though, before the news that this fetus had a condition that was, as they say, not compatible with life. Although they were told that if the pregnancy went to full term, the baby would be likely stillborn, my friends decided to continue the pregnancy anyway. They were convinced that ending this life was not their decision to make. They knew that this child would be a boy, and before he was ever born, they named him Josiah, which means God saves or God heals. Josiah was born while I was out of town for a weekend. When I got home, there were four messages on my answering machine. One friend had taken on the responsibility of spreading information and keeping people in touch. The first message said Josiah had been born and he was alive. Please call. The next two messages acknowledged that I must be out of town or I would have responded. The final message said Josiah is still alive. Please call. But I did not call. I went straight to the hospital. My friends, whom I'm going to call Jack and Jill, were quietly euphoric. Josiah had many things wrong with him, including severe facial deformities. And those things were just not the most important consideration that afternoon. We paid very little attention to what was wrong with him. Do you want to hold him? Jill offered. Of course I did. He was probably deaf, probably blind, and I talked to him anyway. I didn't care. I told him how happy we were that he was there. I told him what a fine, beautiful boy he was. I remarked to Jill how calm he was and only later realized that he was just that weak. While I was there, we watched the minute hand on the clock until it marked the moment of 48 hours of Josiah's life. We celebrated his 2-day birthday singing, taking turns videotaping each other, holding him. I was acutely aware, as I expect all of us were in that moment, that this would be the only birthday video his parents would have. Josiah was not going to have a 2-year-old birthday. Jack, his dad, had to go home to their toddler daughter. Before he left, he spoke quietly to Jill. And then he held Josiah, lingered with him for a few minutes, whispered to him, "Don't go anywhere, little guy. Stay here till I get back." My heart was scalded. I rode down in the elevator with Jack and walked him to his car, feeling so helpless and depleted. It did not matter how much I wanted Josiah to survive and be healed. It did not matter how much I wanted to help Jack in that moment. There was nothing I could do but sit and hold that pain and feel it. Our friend, the information provider, had promised that she would call me during the night if the need arose, whatever time it was. But I couldn't sleep. I kept waking up, thinking the phone was going to ring. I kept remembering Jack asking the baby to stick around till morning. And I remembered the very early days of seminary. Jack was one of the first people I got to know in seminary. And in our mutual anxiety, we kept each other boosted up. I thought of him lying awake through the night, also afraid of the phone call I feared, only knowing that for him the stakes were so much higher. In my fear and grief, the convictions that I developed as an adult were pushed aside by my childhood experience. I prayed every time I woke up that night, and I prayed like a child. I was abject. I begged. I pleaded. "God, whatever you are, please, just please let that baby live till morning. I'm not asking that much. It's simple. I'm not asking that he live forever, just till the morning. You can do that. Please, just let his dad see him again. Come on, please." And when I got up in the morning to get ready for work, the phone had not rung. I was afraid to call the person, the friend that sent out the information, because I was afraid that she would think that my call was the one we were all dreading. But when I got home from work that evening, she had called. Josiah was still alive and still okay. Someone that knew about this family asked me later in the week about them, and I told her about that night of desperate praying. "You know," I said, "when I got up the next morning, I thought, well, now, wait a minute. This is not that hard. I work in a church. I belong to a church. My mom's church is enormous. I go to seminary. All these people have churches. We get everybody we know to sign up for one night. Just pray all night, one night. We can keep this baby alive for years." And I knew. That was nothing in this world but a hopeful fantasy. I knew that. And I knew that it was not my prayer that kept Josiah alive that night. His organs were still strong enough. He was still able to live. And I knew that. But my prayer, pleading for him to live, what it did do was it began to shift my spirit. Gradually, all night long, I became just a little bit closer to acceptance for what was going to happen. I knew that my friends were soon going to be in deep grief, and I knew that I would have to bear witness and be with them in that dark place, and I was not ready for it. The pleading I did through that night helped me get ready. It helped me embrace and accept some of that pain. There were many people in many churches, his grandparents' church, his parents' and aunts' and uncles' churches, the churches his parents belonged to, the churches he worked at, so many people that knew Josiah's condition, and I'm convinced that hundreds and hundreds of people prayed for him, before he was born and after he was born. And I know for a fact that those prayers sustained Jill and Jack. I know that because they told me so. I know the fact that when other people are praying for you, somehow or another, distress is diffused or eased. And I know that people for whom prayer matters, when they are praying for someone, that puts that person in connection with the source of all love. I believe that when we together light a candle for those who have no one to light a candle for them, I believe we are doing something real for those people. I believe that. Josiah's mother told me that afternoon in the hospital that so many people said they were praying for a miracle. What they don't understand, she said emphatically, is we already have a miracle. My son was born alive. I've held him and talked to him and rocked him. He is in my arms right now alive, and that is a miracle. What I hope you will consider carefully is this. I don't believe that prayer was what made Josiah be born alive, but I could be wrong. I don't know. What I do believe is that prayer, their own and other people's, made Jill able to experience that birth as a miracle instead of a punishment or a curse or a wickedness. This child was impossibly damaged, and she rejoiced over the very simple, very ordinary fact that he was born alive. Josiah lived for 2 weeks, and one or the other of his parents was awake holding him for every moment of that time. They were determined that he would not die alone, and when the time came, they were able to let him go and be thankful for the mercy. They cherish those hard 2 weeks as a profound blessing in their lives. And I believe that prayer, their own and other people's, was what gave them the perspective to regard that experience that way. What makes you feel closer to the source of all love? What lets you bear the worst you have to bear and celebrate the most exhilarating experiences? What lets you draw strength when you need strength and rest when you are exhausted? What makes you feel ready, inspired, eager? Can you imagine, pretend for a day if you have to, that whatever response you think of when you hear those questions, maybe that's prayer. What a wild idea. And so may it be.